if you get interested, we have a lot of material here, and you can follow anything that interests you for quite a ways. So anything that comes up that gets mentioned, if you want to pursue it, look around or ask me. We can find some things. For instance, Thoreau is often presented in little throwaway gift-type pamphlets or booklets. Here's a Thoreau anthology entitled The Natural Man, published by Quest Books, The Theosophical People. It's a very nice little way to get the taste of Thoreau. Here's one published in a natural history series that a lot of environmentalists use, Literature of the American Wilderness, Thoreau's Natural History and Other Essays. And again, these are all little tiny books that you can find anywhere. In Hallmark gift stores, they have this little edition, The Bluebird Carries the Sky on His Back, Henry Thoreau. So Thoreau is presented in a lot of popular kinds of ways. And that's all right. It's okay to have that, too. But for us, it's not enough to just think of Thoreau as a memento. He's not a doily on somebody else's furniture. He is really somebody. He's a world-class figure. He's somebody like Pindar or Rumi who belongs as an indispensable element of a planetary culture. Absolutely indispensable. So let's come back to civil disobedience. Let's come back to just two more little quotations, and then we'll move on to Lao Tzu. We're still generating a field of inquiry, and we're trying to make it as large as possible, but we're also trying to pay attention to correlates and parallels and intersections and articulations, and we wish to be attentive as much as can be to these qualities and these junctures. This is page 134 in the Portable Thoreau, near the end of Civil Disobedience. The Webster he's talking about here is not Noah Webster, but Daniel Webster, who was the most powerful person in the American Senate at the time, and a great orator. As Webster was to dictionaries, Daniel Webster was to orators. He was spellbinding. He says, Webster never goes behind government and cannot so speak with authority about it. His words are wisdom to those legislatures who contemplate no essential reform in the existing government. But for thinkers and those who legislate for all time, he never once glances at the subject. I know of those whose serene and wise speculations on this theme would soon reveal the limits of his mind's range and hospitality. Yet compared with the cheap professionals of most reformers and the still cheaper wisdom and eloquence of politicians in general, his are almost the only sensible and valuable words, and we have to thank heaven for him. Comparatively, he is always strong and original and above all practical. Still, his quality is not wisdom but prudence. In other words, thought left by itself will always opt for prudence and not wisdom, will always mistake prudence for wisdom. And we have to be on guard not to be so prudent about ourselves and our life as to not allow for the winds of wisdom to come in and blow through. It's like Dylan Thomas said, a good poem has little chinks and breaks in it so that the thunder and lightning can come through. A bad poet is a technical craftsman who doesn't allow for the mystery of the poetry to occur. So we have to watch out for that. Does somebody jiggle there? Fine. Thoreau writes, "Truth is always in harmony with herself." Mm-hmm. Notice the introduction of gender. Prudence has no gender. Prudence is a neutral. Wisdom is definitely feminine. There's no mistaking it whatsoever. This is not a prejudicial statement. It's human experience. Wisdom is a neutral quality. Our prudence is a neutral quality which has its place, but wisdom is a life value which is feminine. Truth is always in harmony with herself and is not concerned chiefly to reveal the justice that may consist with wrongdoing. He well deserves to be called, as he has been called, the defender of the Constitution. He's saying of Webster in his time, no one defended the Constitution better than Daniel Webster. But Thoreau is saying, wait a minute. That's not what this endeavor is all about. In other words, there's a great experiment which is only formally called the United States. That's not what's really happening. That's not what's really important. It isn't any constitution, structure, thought process that's really important. That only derives its importance from something else which is astoundingly real. And so Thoreau here, remember this is in the conclusion of the essay on civil disobedience. The individual always has the right to withdraw their allegiance to any social form whatsoever. There is no social form in the world, no cultural form in the world that does not draw its sustenance from the individual, either unconsciously or consciously. Now, in culture, generally it's unconscious. Even though it's there, it's not conscious. But in a government, in a state, it's usually conscious, more or less. Here's what Thoreau says about Daniel Webster. There are really no blows to be given by him, but defensive ones. He is not a leader, but a follower. His leaders are the men of 87. That's when the Constitution was framed, in 1787. Just a follower of men who are long since gone. I have never made an effort, he says. I never proposed to make an effort. I have never countenanced an effort, and never meant to countenance an effort to disturb the arrangement as originally made by which the various states came into the Union. He's quoting from a very famous speech by Daniel Webster. Thoreau writes, still thinking of the sanction which the Constitution gives to slavery, and he's going to quote Webster again, he says, because it was a part of the original compact, let it stand. In other words, it's a very peculiar thing. The document, the Constitution, it's not so holy as one would think because it embraced slavery structurally in its rationale. You notice that Thoreau is going right to the very heart of the matter that 140 years ago broke the United States apart. It's not the issue of the North versus the South, or because there was slavery. It was this issue that the structure is flawed in a very fundamental What? There was an amendment to it, incidentally, after 1860. The classic statement in American history about the point that Thoreau is making here is Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. In other words, Lincoln, about 14 years later, restated what Thoreau states in Civil Disobedience, but states it as a principle upon which the reality of the government actually exists. What is it? Of the people, by the people, for the people. But that's the only reality that there is. I don't want to dwell on this so much, but to convey to you the incredible importance about this kind of a statement here. It doesn't matter whether we're Americans or not. It's a statement about the reality of human endeavor. He says, notwithstanding his special acuteness and ability, Webster is unable to take a fact out of its merely political relations and behold it as it lies absolutely. That is, he is unable to be a universal observer of the real in terms of itself. Thoreau was saying this in 1850 about this particular situation. In 1913, Bronislaw Malinowski will publish a monumental book of anthropology called The Family in Australian Aborigines, and will say, in the middle of the book, the whole European endeavor to understand other people is jinxed because we're trying to transpose language engendered in our experience with ourselves to other people who have a totally different experience basis from us. We're never going to understand anything in this way, and our language is always cursed. Because whatever we touch with our minds turns into little miniature European icons. And of course, they're never going to match up to us because they're not European in the first place, or in any place. So it's a point which Thoreau makes here, and which increasingly becomes more and more important as time goes on, until in the 20th century, it has become almost now a cautionary watchword. That the true preservation of freedom in the universe is to keep the wildness of the individual intact. And it becomes the unspoken, unconscious justification for every conceivable breakout in the 1980s. Here's how Thoreau concludes this. He is unable to take a fact out of its merely political relations and behold it as it lies absolutely, to be disposed of by the intellect, what, for instance, it behooves a man to do here in America today with regard to slavery, but ventures or is driven to make some such desperate answer as the following, while professing to speak absolutely and as a private man, from which what new and singular code of social duties might be inferred. And then he goes on. They who know of no purer sources of truth, who have traced up its stream no higher, stand and wisely stand than by the Bible and the Constitution. It's as far as they can go. And drink at it there with reverence and humility. But they who behold where it comes trickling into this lake or that pool, gird up their loins once more and continue their pilgrimage past the Constitution, past the Bible, towards the true fountainhead. No man with a genius for legislation has appeared in America. They are rare in the history of the world. There are orators, politicians, and eloquent men by the thousand, but the speaker who has not yet opened his mouth to speak, who is capable of settling the much vexed questions of the day. We love eloquence for its own sake and not for any truth which it may utter or any heroism it may inspire. And here, of course, is a direct parallel in Thoreau to those who are taking the Thursday night to the dialogues in the Plato, the Meno and the Protagoras. The Meno that we took this week and the Protagoras we're taking next week. Socrates says, when the high level of intelligence is that of the sophist, the best that you can have is a gorgeous illusion. That's all you can expect. That's what that recipe delivers. And if you're looking for some real nourishment for your spirit, you're never going to have it because the recipe doesn't call for that. Whereas the recipe for an individual's freedom, for a spiritual happening, is a totally different recipe. It's not that recipe at all. In fact, the recipe's not in the book. There's no cookbook for the spiritual real. That requires everything that you can do, and not following some portion of what you can do. When you channel yourself, when you limit yourself to one kind of a procedure, what do you expect? You're only going to have a partiality. It's only when you open up and bring into play everything that you are that there's any hope at all that you're going to have who you are. That's the only way. Before Rumi was freed and enlightened, he was an uncannily intelligent professor. He was almost 40 years old. He was a tremendous individual. He had to be shown that that's not it at all. That the love of wisdom is on an amphitheatrical dimension that makes this look like a paltry wedge of illusion. Your accomplishments are nothing. We would say today, so you control an empire that stretches from ocean to ocean, from a couple of light years out in space, you can hardly see the star that this planet is going around, much less anything on the planet. It's inconsequential to what is real. And that man's true nature is that he is free on a universal scale. It beggars the imagination, do you see? That only creative imagination would have any chance whatsoever to consider what a human being is in their protean wholeness. That they are a protagonist for the universe as a whole. That's astounding. It's a scale that goes right off the graphs. All the convenient little graph books don't even have coordinates for that scale of intelligence and freedom. Look here at the very end on page 136 of Civil Disobedience. This is how Thoreau ends this essay. Even the Chinese philosopher was wise enough to regard the individual as the basis of the empire. How is the individual the basis of the empire? In the five-phase energy cycle, the individual is in the middle. We'll get to that in just a moment. Who's the philosopher? Here it's Confucius, Confucius. Is a democracy, such as we know it, the last improvement possible in government? Is it not possible to take a step further towards recognizing and organizing the rights of man? There will never be a really free and enlightened state until the state comes to recognize the individual as a higher and independent power. What he's saying here is that one real individual is a superior power to the entire state. Every time that there is somebody who is real, they take precedent over the whole fictive entourage of projections. It's like Socrates says at the end of the Meno. One real man would be like a solid reality among shadows. Thoreau ends with this. I please myself with imagining a state at last which can afford to be just to all men and treat the individual with respect as a neighbor, which would even not think it inconsistent with its own repose if a few were to live aloof from it, not meddling with it, nor embraced by it, who fulfilled all the duties of neighbors and fellow men. A state which bore this kind of fruit and suffered it to drop off as fast as it ripened would prepare the way for a still more perfect and glorious state, which also I have imagined, but have not yet seen anywhere. Now, at this stage, at the end of civil disobedience, Thoreau is speaking just exactly the way that the old ancient Taoist used to speak in the beginnings of the Han Dynasty. And a book has come down, unfortunately, amazingly, still not translated into English completely. The Prince of Huainan. And so it's called the Book of the Prince of Huainan, or called the Huainanzi. It was a group of people, much like we are a group of people. They collected around the prince of an area in China known as Huainan, about 150 BC. And in there is the same kind of understanding that Thoreau came to in Civil Disobedience. Now, none of that material was translated at that time. He had no idea that that was exactly where it leads to. But good individuals everywhere have a way of coming to very similar conclusions, very similar judgments. Now let's move from Thoreau to Lao Tzu. Notice here that we've got a kind of a parallel. We've got one individual as an example, Thoreau, and another individual as an example, Lao Tzu. Both of them were writers. Both of them were characteristic of the nature of their times. Thoreau as an individual sees himself emerge from the most comprehensive of all the contexts that he could experience, and for him it was nature. So that Thoreau is an individual who emerges from the whole of nature. In a parallel way, Lao Tzu was an individual who emerged from the Tao. So that Thoreau's whole task of his individuation was to engender an experience, first of all, and then a consciousness of nature as comprehensive as he could. So he busied himself in the first regard of having an experience of nature as deep and as wide as he could possibly have, and then to bring it into expression through his writings, so that when Thoreau is walking in the woods, he's experiencing, and when he's writing about his walking in the woods, he's thinking, he's conscious. So that Thoreau's work as a whole, and especially his journal, is the largest epic in that work, His writings are the consciousness, and his living experience was in nature. Notice there's a relationship between nature and the book. It's a primordial relationship. In another parallel, one used to speak about the book of life. And there is a very great tradition of a book which is a book of life. Here, Thoreau's book is the book of nature. But notice, it cannot be written by a committee. It can only be written by oneself. In a parallel, and notice that this is not the only parallel possible. One could have taken the book of life. One, in this case, is me, and I'm taking Lao Tzu. What is the book of his? The Tao Te Ching. The Tao Te Ching related to the Tao. But notice that the Tao cannot be talked about. You can't talk about the Tao. You can talk about nature, but in a legitimate way, you cannot talk about the Tao. When you're on the level of Thoreau and Lao Tzu, you can't afford to deceive yourself even on one of these ultimate levels. You cannot afford that. And so Lao Tzu, understanding that you cannot talk about the Tao, takes a level of the Tao which you can talk about, and that would be the I Ching. So that the Tao Te Ching emerges from the Tao, but the Tao as presented in the I Ching. So that the I Ching becomes the experimental base out of which the Tao Te Ching is the individual expression. Just as for Thoreau, his writings are the individual expression out of his natural base. Thoreau is interested in bringing experience to consciousness. Lao Tzu is interested in bringing consciousness to experience because he makes this substitution of putting the I Ching in. I will go to the Tao Te Ching, just for a moment, two excerpts from the Tao Te Ching. I'm using this new translation of the Tao Te Ching, which I like very much, based on the Ma Wang Tui text. This goes back to the 3rd century BC. It goes back to the time of Chuangzi. It goes back to about 200 years before the Huainanzi was put together. So this is a very legitimate material. This translation of the Tao Te Ching is like the translation of the Dead Sea Scrolls. This is ancient enough text that it puts us back before a lot of editing juggling went on. You have to understand that everywhere in the world, a free individual is a jeopardy to the powers that be. The Emperor Caligula went absolutely ape when he saw the freedom of the individuals coming from Alexandria. That expedition of five people, headed by Philo, that went to Rome in 40 AD. When Caligula saw the scale of human freedom that they embodied, he went berserk and instituted a great hate program against those individuals, and they were characterized as Jews. They were not seen and not characterized as new men. 300 years later, Eusebius calls them the first Christians. He says, why are they the first Christians? He says, because the Christian esoteric practices of our own day are the same as what they write about. There are all kinds of interesting little twists in history. The same thing has happened in China. The Han Dynasty had tremendously powerful leaders. The name Chinese comes from Qin. It comes from a man who literally made the Han Dynasty happen. Built the Great Wall and so forth. And in the Han Dynasty, there were several rulers like Han Wu Ti, who were just so powerful, like Napoleon or somebody, who just remade the geography and remade the mental responses. So that as early as the 2nd century AD, there were many Taoists who were unsure of what Lao Tzu had really written, and so they had to write commentaries in the Tao Te Ching to say, well, we think this is what he wrote. And the first commentaries on the Tao Te Ching appear in the 2nd century. Wang Pi is the first commentator. And as soon as there's a commentator, you realize that nobody can read the document as it is. They're unsure. Well, this text of the Tao Te Ching goes back 500 years before the first commentaries, back to a time when the Tao Te Ching could have been read exactly, precisely as it is. No one needs a commentary. The time of Chuangzi, when all of this was just pristinely there and could be understood just as it is. Here's what is numbered as the first. And of course, if you're seeing this, you realize that the order has been reversed. There's a section on the Tao, and there's a section on Te in Chinese is just what arete means in Greek, virtue. It means the power to do it. Can you do it? Yeah, I can do it. The Te is the individual who's able to manifest the Tao in your individual way. So that the Te, always virtue, always has the quality of someone. So when you speak of virtue, usually you'd have to say, well, whose style of virtue is this? Whose kind of virtue is this? Here, this is the Te of Lao Tzu, the sage, the old man. So at the beginning of the section on the Tao, he writes, translated, as for the way that can be spoken of is not the constant way. As for names, the name that can be named is not the constant name. The nameless is the beginning of the 10,000 things. The named is the mother of the 10,000 things. There's a difference between the mother and the beginning. The mother is the first in a sequence. The beginning is always permeating the present wherever it occurs. The beginning is always beginning, and always there as beginning. Whereas the mother is the way in which, in a material way, a sequence is being established. Notice here that quick insight sees a kind of a jujitsu of procedure that theoretically should be possible. Is there not a sequence which reveals the pattern of the beginning? Is there not some way to arrange a sequence so that the last item in the sequence reveals that there was an undercurrent of presence and beginning all the time? And the answer to that is a resounding yes. Human genius, human love of wisdom, human courage to not be deceived by themselves no matter what has always paid off. We literally, by the end of the 20th century, have an ocean of examples of excellent human beings who have done this done their work well, have gotten us here, we can be free in maybe 2 million different ways. The only thing that we lack is the conviction that it's possible. We have been ground down so much and been taught so much in kind of an odd way that we believe that if you just think about it, that it's so. We forget the admonishment of David Reisman in The Lonely Crowd. Do not be deceived that the ability to think about freedom is freedom. That's not really it. You have to then live it. Find some way to live it. So, going back to Lao Tzu again, the nameless is the beginning of the 10,000 things. The named is the mother of the 10,000 things. So that language has a mother aspect to human things. Anything that is man-made eventually comes out of a maternal matrix, which language is. Therefore, those constantly without desires, by this means, what means? By the means of being conscious that there's this reality and appearance. With the little proviso, I'm quoting a British thinker, a Gurdjieffian thinker named Owen Barfield, one must remember to save the appearances. In this world, the appearances are still important. So it isn't just reality and appearance, junk the appearance and clutch the reality. You can't clutch the reality. There's nothing to clutch. But seeing that the appearances are the only possible response in this world to a reality which exists out of this world, that's the beginnings of wisdom. Then one uses appearances not as a guide for what they are, but as a guide for what they show that is but is not here. That's important. That's the difference between then somebody who's just knowledgeable and somebody who is wise. Then you look at life as a very mysterious protean process. Life is extraordinary. And nature will never lie to us on this level, but will always show quite accurately the impress of what is not there. Therefore, those constantly without desires by this means will perceive its subtlety. This is what's known as subtlety, then. Those constantly with desires, by this means, will see only that which they yearn for and seek. We get, in an illusory horizon, exactly what we yearn for and exactly what we seek. It was this peculiarity that led Jean-Paul Sartre to write a little essay called Condemned to be Free. This is the catch-22 in existence. The difficulty is that you're not clear exactly what you want, because that's exactly what you're going to get. There's no way for you not. That's the recipe you've been following. That's what's going to come out. Notice the little jujitsu here. Write a recipe that leads out, not that leads to things, but that develops freedom. And the universal law is such that this material realm must deliver whatever is keyed into it, whatever recipe you do follow. You can plan in an odd esoteric way to have freedom. And it will work. Incidentally, it will work every time. It's not contingent on you being a special case. Freedom is the natural condition of man's spirit and is not a special case. You don't need special circumstances. whatever the circumstances are, that will do. You can work with anything, even a junkyard like our age. Here's how Lao Tzu ends this little section. These two, constantly without desires, constantly with desires. Notice how you have to say the being with desires. You can't just say, oh, that's not for me. Beware of that. Lao Tzu says, these two together emerge. They have different names, yet they are called the same. Why? Why are they called the same? Because this is the subtle basis of identity. A equals A is the bare statement of identity. It's also a tautology, and yet, nevertheless, it is also an identity. He concludes with this couplet. That which is even more profound than the profound. In other words, all right, here's the source of identity. A equals A as the source of identity is the whole basis of identification. In what context? In language. But there's something more profound than language. What is that? The speaker. Because the speaker can choose to use language, can use to be silent. And so Lao Tzu writes, that which is even more profound than the profound, the gateway of all subtleties. It is the speaker who is real before language is real, who is the gateway of all subtleties. So you can appreciate now that, like Thoreau, Lao Tzu is extraordinarily accurate and uncanny in his thusness. The second quotation from him, I want to go to the beginning of the Te, the beginning of virtue, which is chapter 38, which is on page 7 of this edition. It's actually chapter 1 of the traditional ancient Tao Te Ching, but it's chapter 38. These chapters were added later. There are no chapters in the Tao Te Ching. It's just the original text was just 5,000 characters. Why 5,000? Because in Chinese language, 5,000 is the level at which discursive language flames into insight. It's like a traditional thing. If you learn 5,000 Chinese characters, you're now, just now, crossing the threshold where you're able to think creatively. So that, for instance, one of the standard books that you used to get to learn Chinese was published by Harvard University, called Fenn's 5,000. It was a list of 5,000 Chinese characters. And when you had mastered writing and being able to recognize these 5,000 characters, you were then ready to go out and think in Chinese. I have a copy of Fenn's 5,000 downstairs next to Matthew's and some of the other Chinese dictionaries. The Tao Te Ching is 5,000 characters. In a symbolic way of saying, when you've mastered this, you can put all the books in the world down, because you now are an independent, insightful spirit, and you're not tethered down by any need for books. You are the living book in your own self, and however you move, that's right. However you choose now to move, that's your freedom. Such a person was called Shen, a spirit. The true man is the threshold, and what he does, he has only one function which he really does. He releases his spirit. He lets it be free. What would you do if you could do one act for real in this universe? You would set your spirit free. When you got rid of all the delusions of things that you thought that were important that you could do, the really important thing that you could do as an individual would be to set your spirit free. The freed spirit in Chinese is the Shen, who is said to be an immortal one. That when you look at the continuity of mountains and streams without end, the only real person moving in that landscape of freedom is the Shanti.